So our speaker for Plenary 2 is Shirajit Padam, who's going to speak on five things insurers can do about climate change. And obviously climate change is one, if not the major risk that we as a global society are facing. So it's obviously a very important topic for the globe generally and for insurers in particular. So Shirajit's an actuary at Taylor Fry, and he's got lots of experience in the general insurance industry. He is Chief Editor of Actuaries Digital, so you've probably read his columns there. He's a frantic tweeter. He's a member of the Climate Change Working Party for the Institute and Faculty of Actuaries in the UK. His recent joint paper with Professor Andy Pittman, the climate scientist at University of New South Wales, and John Harwood at Suncor, entitled Can Actuaries Afford to Ignore Climate Change, won the Taylor Fry Silver Prize at the General Insurance Seminar in 2014. And I'd have to say there isn't a Taylor Fry Gold Prize, so it's not like you came second. Shirajit recently gave his current paper to the International Astin Afia Colloquium, which was held in Sydney recently. So I think we're very sort of honoured here to have Shirajit today. Shirajit did fill in at the last moment when our speaker for this session dropped out, but I think in terms of a replacement, I don't think we could really do any better. So thanks very much.
Okay, five things insurers can do about climate change. So I'm going to give you a whirlwind glimpse at the way climate change is affecting insurers. Now, normally climate change presentations, we need like really loud, blaring music, and we need everybody to feel really depressed about the future. And I'm not going to do that. I'm going to try and talk about some of the positive things, some of the actions, some of the things that we can actually do about this, and hopefully give you some ideas to take back with you. So, many of the examples I'm going to give you are global. Some of them are about life insurers, not just general insurers, but I will also talk about Australians, and I will also talk about general insurers, so bear with me. First thing that insurers are actually already doing about climate change is to quit carbon. And by that I mean they've stopped investing in fossil fuels. So insurers are starting to recognise that climate change has a huge impact on weather-related claims costs. And they started to recognise that if you're investing in fossil fuels, it's a great way to increase your claims costs. So AXA Insurance actually said this. This is the global chairman and CEO of AXA. And he said that they were divesting from carbon. So as the chairman said, this was a business issue. It's not an ideological issue. And that's another thing that's going to run through my presentation. People are taking action on climate change not because they are tree-hugging hippies like myself. They're taking action because they realise it makes business sense right now. So what action is AXA taking? Well, AXA is divesting from coal. They are selling 0.5 billion worth of assets in primarily coal industries. And they're putting 3 billion worth of investments into green investments. So these are things that are funding renewable energies and those sorts of things. More locally, QBE has already invested 190 million in four green bonds since 2014, and it plans to invest another 100 million over the next 3 years. Zurich globally has invested 2 billion in green bonds. And again, if you read their recent investment approach, their analyst says this is not a philanthropy exercise. We're investing in these green bonds because they have excellent returns. Now, why is everybody doing this? Why is everybody running away? Well, one of the reasons that people are turning away from coal assets is this idea of stranded assets. And I'll talk a little bit about where this comes from. So the world, actually including Australia, believe it or not, is committed to keeping temperature rises below 2 degrees centigrade. Now, this 2 degrees centigrade has huge implications. It requires massive reductions in fossil fuel emissions and carbon emissions. And actually, to keep to 2 degrees, we're going to also have to work out carbon capture storage as well. It's not just enough to stop doing this. The plans to get us the trajectory to keep to 2 degrees also require us to find carbon capture storage by 2100. If we don't keep to 2 degrees, the consequences are huge on human life, and not just human life. For example, the Great Barrier Reef is not expected to survive if we go above 2 degrees centigrade global average temperatures. So scientists have worked out how much carbon we can emit and still stand a better than 2/3 chance of staying below 2 degrees centigrade. So there's not this is not a certainty, this is only 66% chance, and as you and I know, that's actually not very much. But nevertheless, this is what they've done. And they've worked out that we can only burn 1,000 gigatons of carbon. Unfortunately, by 2011, we had already burnt 500 gigatons of carbon. So we've only got 500 gigatons of carbon left to burn. And that's what's known as the carbon budget. Now, if we carry on burning fossil fuels at the current rate, we will have burnt that all by 2050. So anything we burn after 2050 will increase us over 2 degrees centigrade. So what does 500 gigatons of carbon look like? 500 gigatons of carbon is actually, we actually have access to more than that already. We have access to, we can only burn a third of the fuel we already have access to. So two-thirds of fossil fuels cannot be burnt, or if they are burnt, we will go above the 2 degrees centigrade. So if you're someone who's sitting there owning coal mines, oil wells, you've got to think about what that means. It means that two-thirds of your asset will never be utilised if governments are serious and we get policy action to keep us below 2 degrees centigrade. And so, unsurprisingly, and even the, you know, even the oil companies recognise this. They recognise that that we can't carry on burning the carbon we do. So this is not just the tree-hugging hippies like myself who are saying this. So it's not surprising people are investing for fossil fuels. It's not just AXA. Aviva in the UK has also just recently announced not a divestment, but a challenge to all their companies that they're investing in to clean up their act. The Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Pension Fund, that's actually the largest fund in the world. It has $900 billion in investment, and it is the largest investor in coal assets. That's now divesting from coal. The Californian government has just announced that all the super schemes in the Californian state system will be divesting from carbon. And the list goes on. I mean, IKEA is on there. Other companies who are not divesting are still not going to invest in new projects, such as the Gates Foundation and Oxford University. So all of this says just don't invest in carbon. But there are other reasons why you would not want to invest in carbon going forward that insurers need to pay attention to. First thing I want to talk about is the falling demand in developed nations for energy. So this is, I love this graph, it's a bit complicated, but I love it. This is people trying to predict how much energy was going to be used in Australia. This is the national energy market and demand coming out of that market. So this is back what we were doing historically. You can see the green line coming across, and this is what GDP was doing. You know, everybody said, well, there's a close correlation, and obviously it makes lots of sense. The more economic activity, the more fossil fuels we're going to need, the more energy people are going to need. So let's just keep forecasting. Whoops, what do we do? Let's just keep forecasting it going up with GDP. That's what they did in 2010. But then it came down, but they forecast it again in 2011, going back up, and then it came back down again, and they forecast it in 2012. I'm sure you're very familiar with these kinds of graphs and where people's views take a while to change and recognize a new reality. Back in 2014, they finally came to the realisation that that energy demand is becoming decoupled from GDP growth. So what's happening right now is that we are having GDP growth, but we're not actually needing more energy to fund that. And the reason for that is the huge investment in energy efficiency that's taken place over the last 5 years. It's a silent revolution. People don't talk about it much, but it's actually a massive revolution that's changed things in developed nations. The same picture here you can draw for the US, for Europe, for the UK, and most developed nations. Ah, what about the developing nations? Well, there's actually some interesting things that are going on in the developing nations. This is a picture of New Delhi, the most polluted city in the world. And unlike in say, Australia, this is where all the politicians hang out as well in India. So in New Delhi, you can see, smell, and cough up on a daily basis the pollution around you. Whereas I think in Australia, Canberra has some lovely air, and you know, we don't actually get to see our pollution. And that's actually having a huge political influence. I mean, if you also look at Beijing, which is where all the Chinese politicians hang out, that's the world's second most polluted city in the world. So this is having a huge impact. And you can see, I think it's no surprise that the Chinese government announced this deal with the US last year, just before the G20. Just to remind you about that. Now, what China's committed to do is to, what is this now, to total energy consumption coming from zero emission sources to around 20% by 2030. So this is, they're going to replace 20% of their energy to come from renewables or not from fossil fuels, basically. Now, what is that? That's more than all the coal-fired power plants in China today. That's close to the total energy generation capacity in the US today, and it's 16 to 20 times Australia's capacity. So this means that every year between now and 2030, China plans to put in more power stations than it takes to run Australia each year, and all of those will be without fossil fuels. Majority of those will be solar, actually. So what is China doing? A hell of a lot is the basic answer to that question. This is the other big source about why you wouldn't want to invest in carbon. The rapid fall in the cost of renewables. This graph, and there are plenty like it, this one focuses on solar, how the cost of solar per unit energy has fallen rapidly. I mean, it's basically a vertical line downwards. The same graph is true if you look at wind power, and it's starting to be true for tidal power as well. So economically, it just doesn't make sense to keep investing in coal and all the other fossil fuels for whom the price is stable, even once you allow for the collapse in prices of those products. Here's another thing that's going to affect the fossil fuel industry in a big way. Redheads rejoice is what I've got here. So the choice up till now, in terms of electric cars, cars that don't use fossil fuels, has been very much a choice between performance and being green. But the fact is that this car here is one of the best performing cars in the market. You've heard the presenter talk about earlier this morning, Steve. Electric cars are going to be cheaper, are going to be far more performance than you can even get anything out of a petrol engine going forward. That thing, this is going to disrupt the market in a bigger way, and your companies are already worried about this. Something else that Tesla's doing, they've got this thing here called the Tesla Powerwall, which is a battery for your house. One of the problems with renewable energy has always been that the sun doesn't shine at night and winds don't blow 24/7. But with the Tesla Powerwall and similar products that are coming out, you can have this in your house and you can cut yourself off from the grid and run just on your solar. And that's realistic. This is a consumer product. They're being sold today. So that's the reason why you might quit carbon, which is our number one thing. Number two, see the whole picture. Climate change means everything change. You have to sort of take a step back here. Climate change is going to affect everything. It's clear from the latest IPCC report that implications of carbon climate change are widespread. They will change the food we eat, they'll change the way we live, to our employment opportunities, where we go on holiday, how we generate electricity, investments we make. All of these things in some way drive our economy, and of course that's what essentially insurance is there to protect. So whether it's primary industry, manufacturing industry, or even the tourism industry, they're going to have huge implications. Where are we going to live? What sort of home insurance will we want? What will we own? What sort of assets will we want to have protected? Where will we work? What sort of industries will we need workers' comp policies for? And what kind of things will we need claims management for? All of these things are going to change. What kind of commercial risks will we underwrite? These will all have an impact on insurers. And to think about climate change as just affecting your claims costs is missing the point. This is going to have, over the next 20, 30 years, a huge impact on our economy and a huge way to impact on the way we do business. Here's an example of an industry that's going to change. It's the coal industry from Australia. These are figures from the Mineral Council of Australia. Coal has accounted for 15% of Australia's total exports for the last 5 years, contributed nearly $40 billion in export earnings in 2013, and it employs about 200,000 people, both directly and indirectly. So if we imagine the coal industry disappearing, we have to ask questions like, where do those 200,000 people live now that they're not living in close to coal mines? What kind of work are they going to be doing? What kind of things are they wanting to have insured? These are big questions that we're going to face over the next few years. Another example of that, here's AGL, which is the largest emitter of carbon dioxide in Australia. And it's taking action on climate change. They will never build another coal power station. So don't suggest your kids become experts in engineering and coal power. Any existing stations will close by 2050. Instead, they're going to increase investment in renewables, and they are also selling a solar storage solution like Tesla. So AGL, which currently makes its money by hooking you up to the grid and having coal power stations and selling electricity, is going to give you the option of buying a solar storage thing, which means you're cut off from them. You won't be paying them money all the time. Now, again, they're not doing this because they think it's a nice thing to do. They're doing this because they've realised the reality of electricity generation is changing and they have to respond to the market. And they're doing this because they see this as the best way to make returns for their shareholders. There are also lots of opportunities once you start to think about what this will mean to the economy. Here's a report that recently came out from Swiss Re. There was a similar one from Munich Re. It's a very interesting report. It profiles the risks in solar and wind. They've identified massive opportunities for risk management products, including insurance for the industry. So this is a table from that report. You know, we see the usual things here. We see risks associated with construction and operation that we're very familiar with. But there are also new products, for example, weather derivatives for wind farms, so that they can protect their income when you have unseasonably unwindy weather. And there are also other products we can think about. At the Aston seminar, one of the things they talked about was there's a lot of underwriting expertise out there at the moment for wind farms that are onshore, but there's very little expertise out there for underwriting offshore renewable energy and offshore tidal power. And that's a skill that underwriters are going to have to become very familiar with soon. This is something that's currently working off the size, off the coast of Perth. It's providing both power and fresh water to the largest Australia's largest naval base. So we're going to have to develop new skills, but there are things out there that people want insured that they currently cannot buy insurance for, and this is an example of this. So that's seeing the whole picture and the opportunities that come out of that for insurers. The next thing that insurers, again, are already doing is pull the plug on poor planning. That I'm sober when I said that. Endorse smarter land use and urban growth. So what I want to do, start with a quote from Andy Pittman, the guy I did the paper with. He's a professor of climate science at UNSW. He said, people who build houses in Australia in the bush and they seem terrifically surprised when they burn down. And, you know, this speaks to both poor planning and lack of householder awareness on risks. And this is something that we're going to have to confront over the next few years. I don't know whether you read this. This is the government's plan for Northern Australia, the opportunity to develop economic activity in both Northern Queensland and Northern Territory and Northern Western Australia. It's very interesting reading that paper. I think it's about 100 pages, and they don't mention natural disasters at all or resilience. They talk about they talk about insurance, but only in the context that it's very expensive and obviously the insurers are screwing over the policyholders, right? So we have a little bit of work here to be done in influencing policyholders in terms of understanding that where you build things and what the climate risk is going to mean for that. And, you know, these risks are here now, by the way. This isn't actually climate change is going to make this worse, but we're already having a problem. Explain to people you need to think about where you build stuff. So let's give a nice closer example. This is Narrabeen Beach, actually. If you take a close look, you can see the apartments along the beach here. And this is a picture that can be replicated all across Australia. I'm actually trying to find the statistic, but I can't, which of, you know, what's the average distance between the average Australian and the shoreline? You know, I'd love to find that number, but I don't reckon it's much more than a few miles. Most of our development is all along the seacoast. And sea levels are rising. So this is an example of what sea level looks like. This is back when we had the low pressure event in April. So this wave heights of that event were deemed as a 1 in 20 year event. Okay. As a rule of thumb, every 0.1 meter rise in sea level increases the frequency of coastal flooding events by a factor of 3. That's some numbers from CSIRO's unit out in the Antarctic. So at the moment, we're talking about a half meter sea level rise. It's been predicted by the IPCC on a pretty realistic scenario. And that means, effectively, that this won't happen once in 20 years. This will happen 12 times a year. And if this is your normal 12 times a year, you can see that these buildings are not going to stand much chance of not being flooded. So we can't do much about these existing properties, although it's going to be a huge problem, I think, for banks, actually. But I won't say that too loudly. There are things we can do about new developments, though. This is an example. This is called the proposed development Cyprus Central. It's on the Gold Coast. The development proposal was on a floodplain, as you can see here. And it was approved by the local council. On the proviso, no, they did have a risk management plan, that the developer provides two lifeboats, a three-day supply of food, a tractor, and a helipad. That was the risk management plan for this. And it was the only mitigation required for the developer to get development permission. So this sounds ridiculous, but this is actually the state of our planning system at the moment, because you have councils who make these decisions who have no incentive to say no, don't have the money to fight developers, and basically it's a big problem. I'm going to speed up a bit. Here's another picture. This is California. That's what they were trying to develop, and then they had drought. That's not a sustainable picture. Here's another one, successor actually, Grantham. So Grantham used to be down here, it's now up here. They entered into a land swap arrangement, and last time they had a flood, there was millions of dollars worth of damage that happened down here. Most recent floods, there's not been a problem because they've all been up the hill, and the damage is only in thousands of dollars. So things are happening. Keep up the momentum. Here's an example, IAG, Westpac, Munich Re, part of the Australian Business Roundtable for Disaster Resilience and Safety Communities. They've got a number of projects that they talked about that can be done to improve resilience. That will actually, all of these projects here, raising the wall of the Sydney Warragamba Dam, housing resilience program for cyclone damage, and bushfire resilience in Victoria. All of these programs have a 3-to-1 return. So every dollar you spend on mitigation gives you $3 worth of saved costs for the community. So there are a lot of programs out there that insurers are spruiking that can have positive economic benefits and make business sense to do. Here's another example that you might be familiar with, a levee in Roma. There were massive claims costs. Suncorp said, we're not going to insure you anymore. Council puts in a levy, costs them $20 million, premiums come down by 90%, and Suncorp re-enters the market. So insurers are going to have to cooperate with local councils in doing lots of mitigation and acting as a price signal. Fundamentally, this is a really important part of what we do as insurers. We have to be really good at this, risk pricing at individual address levels. We have to be really good at signaling what is the risk, because the economy relies on us to signal that risk so that things can be done to mitigate against them. If we start falling into the trap of pools like they have done in Florida, where risk is shared rather than priced, then we end up losing any sign of risk signaling. So, last thing, prepare for some tough talking. Regulators, consumers and customers and governments have questions. So, as I've already mentioned about Northern Australia, it's a really good example of governments needing some education around insurance and what it does and what it doesn't. This is a real tricky thing for insurers to do because the government actually wants to shoot the messenger. So we have to get better at those kinds of negotiations and prove those outcomes. Consumers need to be educated a lot. So, for example, did you know that most household policies in Australia exclude actions of the sea? So that means that if this is your house, which is by Byron Bay, this is a real picture, you're not covered for this, for insurers. Now, consumers in Brisbane were horrified when they discovered they weren't covered for flood, and that has caused lots of interesting things, ultimately resulting in less people being covered for flood because prices have gone up. What happens when they discover that they're not covered for actions of the sea and this coastal erosion is going to wipe them away? The regulators are very interested in this, especially in the UK. It says, this is a quote from the governor of the Bank of England. It's the top risk is climate change. UK has the third largest insurance market in the world. Now, we don't have the third largest insurance market in the world, but we have the market that's most exposed to natural disasters in any developed nation. So we have to think about this very carefully. So, that was prepared for some tough talking. And here's my summary of the five things you can do, insurers can do about climate change. Just want to finish with a quick good news story here. This is something that XL Kaplan are doing. They're sponsoring this project called the Sea View Project, where they are going down and filming in 3D, high definition, all the coral reefs around the world, including the Great Barrier Reef. And they do that over periods of time. And they're giving access to scientists and policy developers to see what the impact on these reefs are. So, thank you very much.
Thanks, Shanjit. So if you can sit down and grab the mic, we've got some time. We've got about 5 minutes for questions. So I'm sure there are some questions. Okay, there's a question over here.
Hi. In terms of the, I guess, non-insurance for acts of the sea, do you expect any new insurance products to come out of the market that will cover all the things that general insurance, I guess, generally doesn't cover?
I actually think that we're going to get the opposite, that insurers are going to start excluding such things even more carefully. Insurance is for fortuitous events, things that are unpredictable. But right now, if you have a house that's close to the coastal line, I think it's pretty predictable that you're going to have erosion damage like that. So I think you'd be crazy if you wanted to start selling products like that.
Judge LPWC. Question, how do we price the impact of climate change if, for example, a lot of scientists disagree as to the extent to which it's going to affect our climate? So, for example, the frequency of El Nino events, droughts, what's that going to do to our crops, all that sort of thing?
Yeah, so John Harwood and I did a paper on this last year. We talked about some of the techniques you could use to do the pricing. It's fair to say that the climate science is in the infancy. And the two issues are that climate scientists have been much more concerned about the mean than they have about the extremes. And a lot of the existing models have very large resolutions. So they look at blocks of the atmosphere and the ocean in blocks of like 100 kilometres by 100 kilometres. Which is too small for the kind of resolution we need. But certainly they are starting to improve their modelling, and they're certainly starting to take a lot more, pay a lot more attention to not just the mean outcome, but the 1 in 20 events, the 1 in 30 events, the 1 in 200 events that come through. And I think it's insurers, as is already happening, are starting to collaborate more with people. For example, Suncorp's collaboration with James Cook University in terms of developing those models. Now, do we have an exact answer? No. But does that mean we just ignore it? I think that's not the right approach. I think we need to make, as we always have, judgmental, and to look at scenarios and to look at the impact.
Which insurers do you see doing the most about climate change?
So I think climate change over the last 5 years, say, has become a dirty word or politically unpalatable word. And I think also there was a lot of fatigue that came about by a lot of the stuff that was happening in the late 2000s, particularly after 2007. So insurers have actually been very clever, I think. They've been doing a lot of what they've been doing under the radar. And have been much more talking about, in Australia, talking a lot more about what mitigation activities. And again, I think Suncorp has done a lot about that. IAG have done a lot about that. And all of the insurers have been involved in that. And really, mitigation is a great place to start because you talk about natural disaster resilience, and that's a great way. But that's the first step towards dealing with it.
One more question.
You mentioned that the energy companies are starting to invest into the renewable energies, like AGL, you mentioned. But then in point one, you were saying that everyone's starting to divest from these companies. I feel like there's a systemic risk there that we're going to start divesting from them and they won't have any funding to be able to actually invest in renewable energy.
Yeah, it's interesting because a lot of existing energy companies are moving towards renewables. So if you look at what Aviva, which is one of the largest insurers in Europe and in the UK in particular, have done, instead of divesting from all their investments, they've gone back to them and said, we need you to develop, say, the energy companies, we need you to move your business towards renewable energy, otherwise we will divest. So they have taken an approach where they are liaising and discussing those things with their companies in order to do that. And that might be a more productive approach for them, because if they try and sell all their assets at once, they're going to pretty much lose a lot of money.
Okay, well, I think we'll have to leave it there. I'd just like to present Shanti with this bottle of wine. And can you all thank him once again?
Just a quick coda here. I am the chief editor of the Actuaries magazine. I am very interested in any articles that you might want to write or things you're interested in. Or if you want to be on a list of people who I can contact and say, hey, there's this issue, I need someone to write an article about it, here's lots of research you can do and stick it up, please come and talk to me. And it's a great place to practice your skills. Thank you.